Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Michigan's governor said today that she is hopeful she can start reopening her state on May 1st. That follows the unveiling of President Trump's plan for reopening, in which he said he'd leave it up to the governors.
The president's plan would allow governors to lift social distancing restrictions in three phases if they can meet guidelines that show they're keeping the coronavirus in check. As many as 29 states, mainly in western parts of the country, might start to lift some restrictions within days. Tolu Olirunupa with The Washington Post joins us now with more. And Tolu, the president has said he wants the country to reopen by May 1st. This plan, which is somewhat vague, is a set of recommendations broken up in three phases, and it's a guideline for states. How would that work?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a set of recommendations and guidelines that really allow state governors to make the decision about how quickly to open up their states. It basically gives three phases for different states to be in. If you have had your caseload of coronavirus cases declining for 14 days, you can enter into phase one, which will allow you to start opening up parts of your economy, starting with sort of having people go back to work slowly. People who are elderly or who are still high risk because of pre-existing conditions would still be asked to stay home. People would still be asked to minimize their recreational travel, but that phase would allow people to start the process. And then there are two phases after that. If cases continue to decline for continuing weeks, that would allow people to open up more, allow the economy to get closer to some more of a sense of normalcy.
Okay, so testing is going to be a key to this. On ABC Good Morning America, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, said the priority for testing needs to go beyond the frontline health workers as specified in the president's plan.
Absolutely, they should be tested, but we should be able to administer a test to anyone who has symptoms, ideally to people that are around people who have symptoms, and in the best case scenario, just doing them broadly so that we really get a handle on where COVID-19 is and where the threats are.
And, you know, afterwards, the president tweeted, "Liberate Michigan." How are governors actually going to do this? What kind of pressure are they under?
They are under a lot of pressure because if there's a second spike, if there's a second wave of infection, they are going to be the ones responsible because they have the choice of whether to open up their economies or not. So a lot of governors are saying the same thing, that they want to be able to have widespread testing so that people can be comfortable going back to work, going back to, going to the businesses that they once frequented. But if you don't know sort of whether or not workers there are infected or not, if there's not widespread testing, then people may not be comfortable. Governors may not be comfortable reopening their economy. So a lot of governors, Republican and Democrats, are reaching out to the White House saying, we need more testing. We need to increase the amount of testing, maybe by a factor of two or three before we'd be comfortable sending people back out into society, back out to work. And right now, the White House does not really want to take responsibility for the testing shortfalls. They're saying that the state labs and the state governors should be taking charge of the testing. So that's a little bit of a breakdown in the process right now.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, the president's tweet, "Liberate Michigan." President Trump has also taken a combative approach with other states as well. Yesterday, he commented on Washington State Governor Jay Inslee's trouble finding cotton swabs for tests.
Washington was saying that he can't find cotton because, you know, a swab is a very easy thing to get. And swab is essentially, it's a little bit more sophisticated than a Q-tip. And you got to be able to go out and find. You know, the federal government shouldn't be forced to go and do everything.
I mean, Tolu, you actually just said this, but under this plan, if anything goes wrong, the president can really keep blaming the governors, who he accuses of sometimes underreacting and then overreacting. But can you talk a little bit more at what's at stake for the president, really?
Yeah, it's really interesting. The president is both blaming the governors and putting pressure on them to reopen as quickly as possible, but also he's saying that the responsibility lies with them about whether or not there is a second wave or whether or not there's adequate testing. So he is really shifting a lot of the responsibility onto the governors while at the same time sort of urging them to reopen. And there have been all these protests in various states, and the president seems to be egging on these protests by saying liberate these states, and that people want to leave their homes and want to be able to get back out into society. So it is a very interesting political strategy for the president to be pushing for this reopening, at the same time shifting the responsibility onto the states and onto the governors for a lot of things that the governors say that they can't do on their own. They say they need the federal government to help with the testing, and right now there's not enough testing for a lot of these governors to feel comfortable, but they are still going to be getting pressure from the federal government and pressure from the president to reopen as quickly as possible. So we could see a politically motivated reopening where red states agree with the president and reopen, and Democratic states are more cautious about reopening and wait a little bit longer.
That's Tolu Olorunipa. He is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, people are responding on social media to plans to reopen the country. Let's bring in Femi Ok, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
So first of all, Google and Apple, the two tech giants, in a rare partnership, are looking for a way to use cell phone data to track people who've been infected with the coronavirus. This could be very useful as the country starts to reopen and people can move around again. First of all, how's this going to work?
So this is contact tracing using Android and Apple devices. So what will happen is if you are a COVID-19 patient or you found that you tested positive for COVID-19, your device will alert people that you have been in contact with. But you have to have downloaded a special app. They have to download a special app. And it's important that you and all of these potential people you've been in contact with are in the same system. And then when you alert your app that you have tested positive, the app will then send an alert to everybody you've been in contact with in the past 14 days, and they will be given advice as to what they need to do. So the problem with this is everybody needs to be on the app for it to actually work effectively.
Mm-hmm. And are you getting the sense on social media that people are interested in participating in this?
There's concern. If you think about these two big tech giants, Apple and Google, Paul is concerned about giving his information out. He says, I don't like it. I'm very disturbed by this tracking data. He posts on Twitter. Immediate response from David Pogue. There is no tracking. That's not the idea. No name, phone number, or anything else is recorded. Instead, you just get a notification that you were close with someone infected. You will never know who. Let me give the last word on this subject to a doctor. That's Dr. David Sinclair. And he says that Singaporeans made the same app last month for their citizens and released the code. That's brilliance. These apps are not available yet. Google, Apple, and healthcare authorities are currently working on them for the U.S.
Femi, one issue that we often talk to you about in our weekly segments with you are these climate strikes where tons of young people would gather every Friday, maybe walk out of school to demand action against climate change. The strikes used to sound like this. Okay, and now they sound more like this.
My name is Sophia. I'm from Costa Rica, and welcome to our third week of Tax for Future webinar.
So even these climate strikes, Femi, have had to go online due to the coronavirus.
Yeah, youngsters are protesting from home. A couple of hashtags that I was looking out for. One is hashtag climate strike online. The other one is digital strike. Just in the last few hours on Friday, Elijah posted a very intense photograph staring right down the camera, holding a huge big sign saying climate strike. Post this on Twitter. He says the climate crisis does not go on lockdown. Greta Thunberg, who we've had on Here and Now, actually talks about the transition from offline to online. And she says, we listen to the science, and right now the science says that mass gatherings will cause harm, but that won't stop us striking. The climate emergency is the biggest crisis we've ever faced. It won't wait until after COVID-19 is dealt with, so we can't either. So what the youngsters are doing is actually using their platform, their social platform, to amplify their voices, even though they physically cannot be out there on the streets.
Greta Thunberg echoing something we've heard a little bit more in recent weeks, which is basically if the science is what is driving us to make decisions on coronavirus, why isn't the science what's driving us to make decisions when it comes to climate change? So we'll continue to follow that. I want to ask you about one more thing, Femi. In the time of social distancing, some have found comfort in a letter that went viral, said to be written by F. Scott Fitzgerald when he was in isolation during the 1918 flu outbreak. But it turns out that this is actually a fake.
Well, I would say it's a piece of satire and beautiful writing and very poignant because it really speaks to our own anxieties right now. So the letter addresses the challenges of life during the Spanish flu pandemic. This is allegedly F. Scott Fitzgerald doing this. He talks about Ernest Hemingway being appalled that authorities have asked him not to go to bars. And as far as stocking up on essentials, what is on F. Scott Fitzgerald's list of essentials? He says that Zelda and I have stocked up on red wine, whiskey, rum, vermouth, absinthe, white wine, sherry, gin, the list goes on and on and on. But basically, this was a piece of satire. It was written for an online publication called McSweeney's. And it says very clearly that this is a work of parody. It is not an actual letter written by Fitzgerald, but people have been sharing it, enjoying it, and then also double-checking on each other. They said, you know, you do realize that's not an actual letter, but it does speak to our concerns and how upset we are right now.
That is Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thanks as always.
You're welcome. Take care.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
We've been following how the coronavirus is affecting countries around the world and want to check in now with Russia. That country's death toll is over 200, but there are more than 32,000 confirmed cases. And yesterday, President Vladimir Putin canceled next month's Victory Day parade, which attracts thousands of people every year. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us from Moscow. She's on Skype. And Sarah, first of all, what's the significance of canceling this parade?
Well, this is a huge deal for Vladimir Putin. It's something that Russian politicians and he in particular have been talking about for months and months now. The 75th anniversary of the victory over Nazism, Nazi Germany, by Soviet troops. It's become something of a kind of uniting narrative, really, here in Russia, a real sort of patriotic cause that President Putin has rallied people behind for some months. And so this was to be a huge parade, even huger than usual, across Red Square, Russia parading its military might, and also expecting international leaders to attend that parade. So, of course, as time has gone on, as the pandemic has progressed, it's becoming increasingly obvious that that was not going to happen as Mr. Putin had envisaged. And eventually he finally had to bow to the inevitable and to say that, yes, this anniversary parade would be called off. He said it was a sacred event, May the 9th, Victory Day. But he said the risk in this pandemic was just far too high. He just couldn't take the responsibility.
A few weeks ago, back in March, Putin said Russia actually had COVID-19 under control. I'm just wondering, how has the situation changed since then? And what steps has the government really taken to contain this virus?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the attitude has changed and the approach has changed. At the beginning, there was very much a sense that COVID-19 was a foreign problem. There was an awful lot of coverage on state TV and comments from officials here about chaos and hellish conditions, really, in Europe in particular. Lots of focus, of course, on the awful situation initially in Italy, then Spain. And a sort of sense here, really, that Russia was somehow outside of all of that. And that's even though, of course, Russia has a very, very long border with China directly in the Far East of Russia. So the sort of official line was that Russia had taken steps very quickly to close down that land border, that it had targeted anyone who traveled to China, including Chinese citizens and Russians as well, and was trying to isolate them very quickly. So looking at the numbers, they were saying at the beginning, things were under control here, as you mentioned. That has changed, of course. Now we have more than 30,000 people who have tested positive. And in fact, about a week ago, the mayor's office here was reporting that the hospitals in Moscow are already under extreme strain. In fact, we were told at breaking point, or rather, I should say, on the brink. And that was a week ago. So obviously, the situation has progressed very far, although official statistics still show a very low death rate.
And I want to ask you about that, because there has been some skepticism about that total number of deaths as opposed to those who are sickened, as you said, nearly 32,000 folks. Have you heard that? And what has been the reaction from folks about those numbers and whether they're actually accurate?
Well, I think in terms of the number of people infected, there's a lot of skepticism because, of course, this is a huge country and that's a fairly low number of people infected, even if, you know, you take at face value what the Russian authorities are saying about acting quickly and closing down their borders. And there have been a lot of steps, of course, to try to stop the spread of coronavirus. And they did begin fairly early. I mean, just take, for example, I'm in Moscow here, that the strictest measures in Moscow, we're not allowed out of the flats even to exercise, whereas, for example, in the UK and countries in Europe, people get to go out for an hour to run around or to walk around. Here you get a quick dash to the shop and back. And there is a QR code tracking system for people using vehicles moving around. There are facial recognition technology cameras being used to track movements of people. So, you know, the strict controls in Moscow, I would say, are having playing a role in sort of containing this pandemic in the city. But as to the numbers, some skepticism. But I would say in terms of the death number, we're not getting reports of for example, cemeteries being overrun, crematoriums being overrun, that kind of thing at this point. But certainly, I think you know, people are a little bit dubious looking at the figures, wondering why it's so low.
You also mentioned the strain on hospitals. Can you give us a sense of how the Russian healthcare system is actually coping with this?
Well, the official word is that it's already struggling. Certainly, they have mobilized an awful lot of beds here. As the terminology is mobilizing beds. But anyway, they've made a lot of beds available in hospitals here. They have said from the very beginning that there are enough respirators, there's enough equipment and enough staff. But at the same time, students have been brought in. Professors from medical universities. The military has put up across the country some 16 military field hospitals as well to cope as the pandemic increases. So at the moment, the hospitals are coping, but certainly this is a health system which is fairly, struggles on an ordinary day. So I think, you know, it is fair to say that it is going to find this increasingly difficult as the numbers increase. But I suppose that's the case for health systems right around the world.
It's very true. That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Sarah, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
Well, Americans are streaming more TV than ever, on average 8 hours a day. That is according to a survey by the streaming service Tubi. But nearly all TV production has stopped in the wake of the pandemic, so supply won't meet demand for new shows. Let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So studios can't make shows right now, but the sinking economy has forced advertisers to cut budgets, which has especially hurt network and cable TV. How are they trying to adapt?
Well, it's interesting. There's a few different things going on. In network TV, for example, they've had to wrap up seasons of some of their regular series earlier than they planned because they ran out of episodes and they had to stop production. By the same token, they're trying to figure out how to take some new shows and salt them throughout the summer so that they have new material to constantly present to people. And then you have a show like American Idol, for example, that had pre-recorded a lot of the music competition stuff, so they're able to air those episodes. But now they're coming up to the part in the competition where there have to be live performances. And the judges and the performers can't get together in the same place. They can't have an audience. And it's not even clear, you know, what they're going to do. And then you look at some of these premium outlets like HBO, and they have delayed some of their bigger series. HBO had a series with Nicole Kidman that they have indefinitely delayed. They have a project with Mark Ruffalo that they've pushed back for a couple of weeks. So every outlet is kind of dealing with it in different ways.
Eric, I have to wonder if at any point one of these outlets is going to say, why don't we take the 100 or 200 or 500 people that it takes to produce something, quarantine them all for a couple of weeks, and then we can actually do it during this pandemic.
Well, you know, if you could test people,
right,
you know,
right.
And get the results in a timely manner, you might be able to do that. But I don't think that's feasible for the majority of the workforce in television, mm-hmm. because they work on too many different projects and there's too much travel involved. There are going to be some TV shows that will try to create new episodes in this new environment. So we saw Saturday Night Live, for example, do an episode where everything was filmed through Zoom or some other sort of video messaging service. And all of the cast members and all of the production people and all the writers were all at home.
It was interesting to see, by the way, how many of them live in Los Angeles and not New York when they did that.
Exactly. And, you know, I was trying to look to see what their apartments look like. You know?
Right, so, right.
That was really... Colin Jost looked like he had the flyest apartment anyway. but there are, you know, TLC's 90 Day Fiancé is doing a version of the show where couples who have been on the show will all take footage of how they're living in lockdown, and then they're going to create a limited series based on that. That starts next week. CBS's All Rise, which is a legal drama, is going to do an episode that is entirely filmed the same way. It'll probably be the first scripted show that we'll see filmed in this way for a national broadcast network TV audience. So it'll be interesting if they pull that off. I expect that we'll see other shows try to do something similar.
What about the streaming companies like Netflix that don't have to worry about ad revenue since people pay to subscribe? We know that their stock price has been reaching all-time highs even during this crisis. How are they holding up?
Well, that's one thing I forgot to mention is that this is a double-edged sword for some outlets in the TV industry, because for broadcasters and in cable TV as well, they're seeing record amounts of viewership. But you can't monetize that larger audience because it's harder to sell ads. And of course, the streamers don't have to worry about that. So we just saw this week, for example, that theoretically the value of Netflix has grown greater than the value of Disney for the first time ever. Hmm. Now, in addition, we're seeing the streamers try to change things to make people sample them while they're stuck inside. So HBO, for example, put about 500 different items outside of its paywall. So you can watch full seasons of The Sopranos, The Wire, Veep for free. Showtime has extended its free trial to 30 days. Quibi, the streaming service that has short form videos, 10 minutes or less, they have a 90-day trial period. And Sundance Now has a 60-day trial period. So they'll say, hey, we'll give you free access, give you an extra long free trial, and see if you might want to stick with us when everything gets better.
Well, I actually have a whiteboard that I cross off the shows as I've seen them. I'm done with Tiger King. I'm done with Unorthodox.
You are
I'm
so
watching
organized,
Insecure's
dude.
Latest season on your recommendation. And we'll see what comes next. Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And during this pandemic, a handful of states are restricting abortion access, deeming it an elective procedure. Abortion rights groups have now sued, and some federal judges have ruled against such bans. NPR's Sarah McCammon is covering this story. Sarah, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Yes, yeah, so tell us more about what's happening in these half dozen or so states. Really, what justification are they giving for why abortions should effectively be banned right now?
So a handful of Republican governors and attorneys general say this coronavirus pandemic is an emergency, and they argue that abortion should be seen as an elective procedure and should be canceled during the pandemic. They point to the shortages of medical supplies like masks and gowns, and they argue that any procedure that might use those should be put off. And it's important to note that these policies are being enacted by conservative state officials who have a record of opposing abortion rights.
Where does the medical community stand on this issue?
Well, several medical groups have weighed in, saying this decision should be left up to patients and doctors. The National OBGYN group, known as ACOG, says abortion is time-sensitive and delaying it can cause problems for pregnant patients. It can become inaccessible at later stages because of state laws restricting abortion at certain gestational stages. And also that the procedure is just safer earlier in pregnancy. And reproductive rights groups have noted that medication abortions in particular require relatively little protective equipment, known as PPE. And most abortions do not use hospital beds because they're typically outpatient procedures. Meanwhile, though, conservative groups are calling for abortions to be suspended.
You mentioned medication abortions. Planned Parenthood announced this week that it's expanding access to telemedicine to all 50 states. A number of Democratic senators are calling for the FDA to actually relax restrictions on a drug used for these medication abortions. Will patients get more access to medication abortions?
So telemedicine abortion is typically regulated by states. The federal government regulates the key abortion pill that's used in most medication abortion procedures, which is called mifepristone. It's heavily restricted in the U.S., unlike in Canada, for example. And reproductive rights groups have been asking the FDA to relax those rules for a long time. But it seems unlikely that under the current administration, which has worked to limit access to abortion and contraception, we will see those federal rules relaxed anytime soon.
We're reading these stories about women driving for hours to try to find a clinic where the procedure is performed. What has this meant for patients who want to seek abortions?
Well, I've spoken to a couple of women who've told me they have had to make long trips to clinics in other states because of bans. These are often patients who are facing economic stress. So getting time off of work, if they still have a job during the pandemic, can be hard. And abortion rights groups say for many of these women, it means they just won't get an abortion and will be forced to continue an unwanted pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned a little earlier the rulings in Texas, among other states, against these bans. What does this mean for abortions there?
Right. There has just been a rash of litigation in all of these states. And so far, reproductive rights groups have gone to court and have successfully blocked or at least rolled back to some degree those bans. But litigation is continuing in these cases, and anything could change. It's very much in flux. It's also worth noting that some states with conservative governors are talking about resuming more normal operations soon. So if some of these overarching bans on elective procedures are allowed to expire in the coming weeks or months, that could have the effect of meaning that abortion is more accessible in those states, too.
That's Sarah McCammon, NPR national correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The restaurant industry is among the sectors of the economy hit hardest by the pandemic. Restaurants have been ordered to close, and even when they are allowed to reopen, it could be a while before people feel comfortable crowding into a space for a meal. New York City chef and restaurateur Tom Colicchio of the Bravo series Top Chef closed all of his restaurants and has had to lay off more than 450 people. He warned that with no assistance, 75% of restaurants in America would never reopen. I started our conversation asking him why.
If I were open today, the money I'm receiving today goes to pay bills that I incurred, 30 to 45 days ago. And so knowing that restaurants don't have a reserve and a decent idea of the length that we would be closed, and the effects that it would have on the economy, I just think it's going to be a struggle for restaurants to get open.
And you say that the CARES Act, the economic relief package passed by Congress, does not go far enough for restaurants. What do you think that it should include, or what do you think the next package should include for restaurants?
Sure. I think there needs to be a fix to the CARE package and to the PPP program. First is it provides payroll for up to 2 months, and it provides additional money, 25% of whatever you receive can go to rent and utilities. Now, that works for businesses that are currently open. If you're not open, it doesn't work, because what it's going to do is, let's just say I'm approved today. I get my money in 10 days. I have to have the majority of my staff hired by June 30th. I don't think I'll be open by June 30th. And so what happens at that point is money is going through to pay for payroll and to pay for rent, but I'm going to run out of money before I'm open. And, yes, I can pay my employees for 2 months, but they're already on unemployment. And so what we're asking for is the date of origin, which is the date that we have to start hiring people back. The date of origin is pushed back to when we actually open our restaurants. And then I believe we need 4 months of payroll protection. So if I can open my doors, let's just say it's August 1st, then I have 2 months of my payroll being taken care of, 2 months of my rent being taken care of. Then I think I can start catching up to my accounts payable. I could start paying my other bills as well that I'm going to have to pay before I get open. And then hopefully I have some runway to actually get open. The next step, and that would be a restaurant stabilization package, where a bunch of money can come in either as loans and grants that could be used for a mixture of things to keep us open. Because if you think about how many people the independent restaurants actually employ, we're talking about 11 million people. And so if half those restaurants manage to get open or close 2 months later, we're talking about another 5.5 million people who are back unemployed again. Because also when I open up in August, I'm not going to be anywhere near capacity. And so if we're operating at half capacity, we're losing money.
So when do you think you'd be able to operate at full capacity?
That's not the question. The question is, when does the public believe that it's safe to go into places that are busy, that are crowded? And that's not going to happen until we get a vaccine.
Let me ask you about something that President Trump said about the restaurant industry last month before the passage of the CARES Act. Listen to this.
What we're doing in terms of loans, what we're doing in terms of salaries, they'll all come back. It may not be the same restaurant, may not be the same ownership, but they'll all be back.
What do you think of that?
I think at best it's just, it's just misinformed. Number one, we're not asking for a bailout. We're asking actually to get back open so we can actually employ our people. I just think it's very cavalier of him to say, well, it's going to come back in some form. Getting to some specifics out of the president would be great right now. What are you doing in terms of payroll? What are you doing to support small businesses and restaurants? It's one thing to say, yeah, we're supporting people. I want to know what the plans are. PPP doesn't go far enough. I think if he spent the time to actually look at PPP and what it does and what it doesn't do, he may have a different tone. But I think acting cavalier, like, well, they're going to come back in some form, some shape, whenever, I don't think he quite understands how devastating this has been to small businesses. We're going to see a lot of empty storefronts. And this will go on in every single city. This will go on in every single small town across this country. And so, is there an inkling of truth there? Yeah, eventually they'll come back in, 10 years, 15 years? That's just not good enough.
I want to ask you, just to help our listeners understand something, because I think a lot of people, they feel right now like, I want to support my local restaurant. They've stayed open with takeout and delivery. Will that be good enough to get these restaurants through, the ones that can do that anyway? It's not really anywhere near the same, is it, Tom Colicchio?
No. In fact, a lot of chefs that I'm talking to, they started doing takeout or delivery and they realized that it's just not going to work. I mean, number one, they still have to go through a lot of the delivery businesses, the DoorDashes of the world, and they're charging 30%. That's not sustainable. Also, restaurants aren't really made to do that. And we can adapt and we can change, but that's going to have to happen, I think, for us to supplement our income when we're at full service. I think right now it's not enough. A lot of the chefs that I'm talking to who started that business, they're realizing that they're just losing more money every day. The other thing that I factor into, because I thought about doing it and I decided not to, in my restaurants in New York City, if I have my cooks come in, they have to take public transportation. And I'm listening to the scientists and the doctors, and they're saying people need to stay home. And so for me, I'm not willing to put my staff at risk for the couple thousand dollars in business that I'm going to do. And again, keep in mind that the majority of my staff right now are unemployment. And unemployment in New York is actually fairly attractive. It pays slightly over $1,000 a week. And they pushed it out to extend it for a much longer time that you can actually receive benefits. And so I'm not willing to put my staff at risk for that now. This is why I think it's really important to get, you know, more testing, especially antibody tests, because it would really change if I knew 10 of my cooks have had COVID. They can't be affected. They're not going to infect anybody. That would change my calculus in terms of opening and what I would do right now.
Are you worried about restaurant employees, from busboys to line cooks to bartenders, not wanting to come back into the business once this is all over, especially if they have to go through months of unemployment?
No, I think they'll come back if the jobs are there. And this is why we're focused on this, the Independent Restaurant Coalition. We want to get back open so we can provide those jobs. And absolutely, I think they come back. My employees, not all of them, but most of them, they love what they do. They love serving people. They like, you know, hospitality. I mean, we have a big sign in our office. It's painted in red letters across the whole office. And it says, make people happy. And it's up there because that's what we do. You could say we produce great food and we have a great wine list and bar program, but ultimately that's what we do. Everyone on my team, that's what they're committed to. And there's something about that that isn't taught, but you have to have something inside you that is willing to go out there and go the extra distance. And so people, they sign up for that because they love to do it. They love to be with the people who do it. You know, right now we're hearing from our staff, and what we're hearing is they really misses each other. Restaurants operate like a family. And so I think that plenty of our staff will want to come back. And in fact, we're hearing from every day how they want to get back in there and they want to do what they do.
I want to ask you one more question. Sure. I have to say, personally, I cannot wait until I can go to a restaurant again, because I think it's such a great and fun and a delicious thing to do. But a lot of Americans have started to cook a lot more than they ever did before. Are you worried that people's eating habits have changed and they may not need or want to go to a restaurant as much as they did before COVID?
No, I think that's great that people are actually cooking for themselves. Number one, they'll appreciate when somebody else cooks for them even more. but also, I think that people, you know, they're understanding now where their food comes from, what it takes to actually produce that food. But again, it's, you know, restaurants aren't only about food, and that's coming from a chef. Restaurants are cultural institutions. They become anchors in your community. It's a place where you go to celebrate, you know, a graduation or an anniversary or a birthday. It's a place where you can go where, you know, the old song, where people know your name, where you feel like you're part of it. And restaurants are also there to help fundraising activities. You know, every time there's a charitable event going on, they want chefs there to participate because chefs bring people in. They also want chefs to be part of those packages for donations and things like that. And I think those cultural institutions, not only restaurants, but, you know, you think about musicians and you think about artists and you think about museums and things like that, and libraries, and our cultural institutions need to be taken care of, because after this is over, that's exactly where we're going to want to go to feel better again.
That is chef and restaurateur Tom Colicchio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you. Stay safe.
And if you are in the restaurant industry in any way, let us know how things are going. When do you think you might reopen or get back to work? We're at hereandnow.org, or I'm on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson.
When movie theaters closed due to the pandemic, a lot of film releases were either postponed or moved online. One that was caught in the middle is called Sorry We Missed You. It's the latest from acclaimed British director Ken Loach, and it opened in a few theaters right before the shutdown, then fell into limbo. Now it's found a new life online, and it couldn't be more timely. Howie Moshevitz of member station KUNC has more.
Sorry We Missed You opens on a black screen and a man's voice.
Roofing, flooring, paving, flagging, plumbing, joinery. I've even dug graves. I've done it all.
It's a job interview.
Yeah, I'd rather work on my own now and be my own boss.
The character Ricky doesn't realise what he's getting into.
You don't get hired here. You come on board. We like to call it onboarding. You don't work for us. You work with us. You don't drive for us. You perform services
This is the gig economy, which director Ken Loach, a longtime champion of the working class, says is based on a mind game.
It's a way of suggesting to the worker that he's an entrepreneur in his own right, and he's having a contract to provide a service. And once he's made that contract, he has to provide the service, or he's fined, or his contract is terminated. And it can be terminated at a moment's notice.
Ricky's wife is also stuck in the new gig economy. She's a caregiver who gets paid for a fraction of the time she works.
So you have a contract, I get paid for the visits.
Well, what about your travelling time?
I pay my own bus fare.
And also she doesn't get paid for travelling between appointments. So in an hour she might get paid 20 minutes, but spend 40 minutes on a bus.
Ken Loach has been crusading in films for some 60 years. His last, I, Daniel Blake, was about the horrors of the British healthcare system and won him the top prize at the 2016 Cannes Film Festival. As with most of his movies, the challenge of Sorry We Missed You was to make what Loach calls a cinema film and not a lecture.
You can't make a film about an issue, or not a cinema film, really. You can make a documentary, but in a fiction film where you're driven by characters and by relationships and by experience, you have to find the human core to the story.
On many of his films, Loach has collaborated with screenwriter Paul Laverty, who says that to find that human core meant talking to people and seeing up close the lives they lead. But because drivers don't have fixed offices, Laverty says he had to track them down in parking lots before and after their shifts.
Early in the morning and in the evenings. And I spoke to drivers. I tell them exactly what I'm trying to do. Not to copy their lives, but to be informed by their lives. And you always find people who are interested if you listen to them carefully and with respect. And so over the weeks and months, I persuaded some of them to let me come with them and do the work with them. And it's then that you really get the gold dust.
Laverty was shaken by the internet devices the drivers must carry, which direct them, track them, and control their lives.
And you just see how hard they work, how they're tied to a machine, how they're tied to an app. You know, there's no time to eat. There's no time for toilet breaks. You see photographs of their children on the dashboard. Then you begin to sense how unrelenting and how measured and how monitored they are by this new technology.
And they're never home. So it was in missed family connections that Laverty and Ken Loach found their cinema movie.
The story of the gig economy, of insecure work, is about the family, because this is where all the pressures arrive. Their economic circumstances force them to the point of disintegration. So that's why we arrived at a family rather than a polemic about and generalizations about the gig economy.
The character Ricky is attacked and beaten by thieves who steal parcels for which he's financially responsible. His son tries to stop him from going to work the next morning.
You can't go like that, man, Dad. Look at the state of you. You've only got one eye that works. And you probably end up going to kill yourself when you're driving.
Son, I've got to go to work. I have not got a choice.
Tan, I just want you back. The way you were, the way everything was.
Filmmaker Ken Loach wanted to avoid the stylization and polish that comes with trained actors. So those in Sorry We Missed You are working class people. Chris Hitchin, who plays Ricky, has been a plumber.
What we try to capture is something authentic, you know, a kind of genuine response, a sense of spontaneity, sense of the events unfolding in a way that's surprising to the people in the film, just as it would be in real life. And just that sense of danger, you know, so that you just feel that you really are watching something unfold rather than something that's been rehearsed and planned and premeditated. But I don't know, I mean, that's the aim. It doesn't always work, but that's the aim.
Sorry We Missed You is streaming as part of a project launched by its distributor, Kino Lorber, which splits revenues with the art houses that used to show its films. For NPR News, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.